Thomas Kuhn versus Popper, The Struggle for the Soul of Science. Also, Thomas Kuhn, A Philosophical History of Four Four Times.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank Halil for inviting me. I'm not sure I'm the most natural person for this conference, but let's have a go at it. I'm certainly someone who has taken inspiration from Karl Popper, but I want to bring this into a sort of a broader perspective, in a sense. And so, for those of you who want to follow up what I say, there's my email address, and the topic that I'm going to talk about is morphological freedom. Just out of curiosity, how many people in this audience have heard of this concept? Just raise your hands if you've heard of this concept, morphological freedom. Nobody. Okay. I won't get to it quite yet. I'll get to it later on. But let's start with what's already been discussed here today. When we talk about tolerance as something that we want to, in some sense, approximate or achieve or see as a kind of normative ideal, at least for the way in which we conduct our everyday business with people, one of the things that's presupposed, and this is something I brought up in the question in the first panel today, is that we have a clear jurisdictional understanding of what's yours and what's mine, what's the difference between, right? There's a boundary between which we can clearly define the difference. Okay? And that both sides, on either side of this divide, recognize the difference in the same way. So we realize we're both dealing with different things. I'm on one side and you're on the other side. Now this kind of idea is not trivial, okay? Tolerance depends on it, but it's not trivial, and it has a lot to do, at least in the history of the West, it has to do with the rise of individualism, okay? I'm not necessarily the person you want to have up here to defend individualism, because I have a lot of issues with it, but this is the basic kind of point at a metaphysical level. At a metaphysical level. Namely, that you have to understand that there are two different beings and they have different views, and both sides of the divide recognize that there are differences between the views. Okay? And as long as that's well understood, you can talk about a climate of tolerance. Okay? Now, why does this arise in the history of the West? It has a lot to do, first of all, with Christianity. And the idea that everybody who's created in the image and likeness of God individually has a soul, and each soul, as it were, is a kind of fallen soul in some sense, having been descended from Adam, but at the same time also a soul that has free will and can decide what to do about itself. And this soul, as it turns out, corresponds to the body in which the soul is placed. So individuation, right, from the Christian tradition is where, you know, you've got different decision points that correspond to different bodies. Okay, and that's what individualism is about. And of course, people will make different decisions and take different courses of action and so forth. And it's against that metaphysical backdrop that tolerance becomes possible, where there's this kind of recognition of that. Now, I say this not because I'm trying to promote Christianity or anything like this, but rather because I think that when you start to have a kind of more blurred view about what identity is and what exactly one identifies with, then the issue of tolerance becomes much more difficult. Okay? So in other words, if the individual is not seen as the decision point on which one makes all kinds of important judgments and actions with regard to life and so forth, then there's an open question. And this is why I brought up the question in the first panel with regard to, well, look, One of the reasons why it might be hard to have tolerance is because I might think I know more about you than you do. And that's because we're the same thing. Okay? And I do think that that's kind of a very important issue here to keep in mind here. Right? So individualism, right? And individuation generally as a metaphysical notion is a very important point when we talk about tolerance, because if that issue can't be sorted out properly, then there isn't really tolerance to talk about here, right? There's going to be inevitable conflict, because basically what you're talking about is two decision points that claim overlapping jurisdiction over something. Right? And then the question becomes, how do you resolve that? That's not an issue of tolerance. And that's why we have things like laws and things like that. Okay? You know, if you want to know how to do the history of this, right, it's the history of property and property claims and so forth. That's really what we're talking about here. Namely, you know, I'm not just me here, but I'm also there as well. And maybe you think you're there as well, but maybe you're not. Okay, so the history of property law is one place where one might want to sort out this kind of issue. I say all this in a sort of introductory fashion because I don't think tolerance is really the issue with a lot of these issues that we're talking about, implicitly at least, with regard to religion and secular state and all the rest of it, and also with regard to where the future is going. Because I don't think there's a sufficiently clear sense of individuation or individualism where one can make, as it were, mutually agreed understandings that this is mine and this is yours. Okay? I think that's kind of blurred in a really radical way. And so tolerance, in that kind of classical sense that John Locke was always talking about, I don't think is really on the table. I think we have to really talk about something that's a bit more explicit in where we're going with this. Okay? So I started on this point because I often find the talk about tolerance to be superficial, to be perfectly honest. It's too superficial because it doesn't really take seriously the metaphysical assumptions of the people who are involved in the disputes we're talking about. Okay? So that's one issue. To be honest with you, I didn't come here intending to say this. But I say this as a result of what I've heard so far. Okay? I'm actually intending to talk about something in the future. Not stuff that in a sense relates to the past. Okay? And this is where and morphological freedom is kind of the issue, right? Because morphological freedom, okay, it's a term, if you're not familiar, and I don't mean to scare anyone here. I don't know what the intellectual threshold is of this audience. But there is this movement called transhumanism, which talks about what I have called in my most recent writings, humanity 2.0. Right? Humanity 2.0. Right? Where do we go from here? What is it that we want to extend forward into the future? Okay? And obviously, people have many different kinds of views about this. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about this, and I'm going to get to Popper's issues in the book Objective Knowledge. We haven't really talked so much about Popper's metaphysical views of things, but I think it's actually quite interesting in this context. Is what is it that we identify with as human beings going forward? Because clearly over the course of evolution, human beings have changed a lot, and human beings have changed in many different kinds of ways, and we obviously live in a wide variety of societies and so forth. So in that sense, there's been already an enormous amount of morphological freedom to people. But most of the morphological differences that exist among people haven't been ones that have been freely chosen. But what if we introduce this as one of the things that we think is part of what it is to be a human being? In other words, we want people to actually live the kinds of lives they want to live in a society with other people who will live also different lives that they themselves have freely chosen. That is ultimately what morphological freedom is about. Even though it is a phrase from transhumanism, it is nevertheless a phrase that I think people who believe in the general Popperian open society viewpoint should be able to resonate with. Okay? So this isn't just science fiction futuristic stuff, but in a sense, part of what I'm trying to do here is to try to make Popper relevant to the 21st century. Okay? And one way in which we have to start thinking about things more seriously, you know, in a sense, pushing Popper's boundaries, as it were, is that if you read the book Objective Knowledge, okay, and Epistemology Without a Knowing Subject, that book, that article that's in the book, it was a speech originally, right, he talks about these three worlds. And so we've got the first world, and the first world is the material world, and it's the world in which we're embodied as human beings, normally understood under kind of, you know, physicalistic laws, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the second world, and the second world is the intellectual world, understood in a very psychological kind of way, so in the sense of belief that Popper, Popperians usually use in a very disparaging way. This word belief is kind of merely psychological, right? But then there is this third world, which in a sense is something that is kind of produced as a maybe unintended consequence, actually, of the interaction of worlds one and two. And this is the realm of objective knowledge, and it's the stuff that's in books. And it's the sort of thing that Popper believed that if civilization should collapse and we had a nuclear war, that in a sense a civilization from another planet could rebuild what the human beings knew, right, by looking at this stuff, right? So they could go back to the libraries, they could do all this kind of stuff, and they could kind of reinvent, recreate, right, all the stuff that made us how marvelous we were in the short time that we were so marvelous. Okay? Now, and in the context in which he presents this, which I think is actually a quite compelling idea, actually, I don't disagree with it at all. And in fact, it was not even unique to him. I've sort of looked into this, and you can find this in Wilhelm Wundt and in Joseph Schumpeter and in Moritz Schlick. There's a sense in which this kind of idea was kind of around in the middle third of the 20th century, where in a sense what you basically are getting is this idea that some sense of a sort of objective sense of knowledge is an unintended consequence of very material, localized, specified beings interacting with an environment over a long period of time. Okay, so but what's interesting about Popper when he talks about this is one of the things that he says in the context of this is that science plays, of course, obviously a very important role. And the way he puts it, and I looked at this just before the talk, right, page 122 of Objective Knowledge, if you've got the edition, Oxford edition, he says, right, that our ideas die in our stead, right? So in other words, what's going on here, you know, you might say the morphological freedom that Popper ascribes to us is at the world two level, right? In other words, is at the level of the psychology, of the beliefs, and so forth. And world three kind of allows us, you know, kind of enables us to reflect on what we've been thinking. So we've got whatever happens in the world, what turns out to be fact, and then we can change our minds. Popper doesn't talk about much about how we can change our bodies, okay, and even how we are embodied in order to enable ourselves to amplify or realize better World 3. He doesn't really talk about that. But it seems to me that this is kind of the issue on the table if you're a transhumanist, okay? Because transhumanists are all about the enhancement of the human body, right? Because that is a vehicle by which then one will amplify the intellectual powers, which will in turn lead to the relevant sources of artifacts, traces, whatever you want to call it, that populate World 3. And it's on the basis of those things, right, that then some ancient civilization in the some rather futuristic civilization can come down and discover what we were about. So we might say, and this is, you know, Popper didn't say this, but, you know, you might say, well, God, you know, as long as we've got the DNA of everyone preserved, right, as long as we have got, you know, we've got the recorded digital recordings of everything that's been there, then some civilization in the future will be able to reinvent us, to reenact us, and perhaps even for us to be resurrected, right? And this is where it starts to get interesting from a theological standpoint, because then there's an issue about what is it that we ultimately identify ourselves with? And see, in this respect, I think Popper always dodged the identity question, because it seems to me, the way I read Popper, is that Popper saw us as kind of dualistic creatures. We're a bit of World 1 and a bit of World 2. And then we create this wonderful thing called World 3. But World 3 is really where the action is. Okay? And so then the question becomes, okay, you know, as we move forward, then what if we can, you know, because Popper didn't imagine that we might actually be able to encode a lot of our bodily character into some world where we could be resurrected. You see, and it seems to me that this is kind of the interesting issue that transhumanism poses to the Popperian picture. If you want to really talk about an open society in the broadest, most cosmic sense, okay? Because it's not just simply about people changing their ideas and changing their beliefs, which is the World 2 thing, but it also involves the World 1 thing, where we can kind of perhaps, given what we, you know, increasingly knowing about biotechnology, we can come in and out of existence in the physical sense. Okay? And so having the freedom to be able to do that might be something that in the future may be seen as just as important as being allowed to have the right to change one's mind, which is something that at the moment we put as a kind of benchmark for living in an open society. And I'll stop there. Okay? Thank you.